netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our focus on this episode is Andor Season 2, which was nominated for an Emmy in the Outstanding Special Visual Effects in a Season or a Movie category. Our guest is Scanline VFX supervisor, Sue Rowe. She and Mike discuss Scanline's approach to large-scale environment work, such as the hospital sequence, which is built from a single redressed set floor, the expansive wheat field, and the digitally constructed temples covered in vines. Rowe also discusses her focus on physics, scale, and the subtle environment effects that help sell a shot. So let's go ahead and cross that conversation now.
Hey, what's it like at Scanline?
It's a crazy bunch of mavericks who, when I first started, I thought they're just all mad. But I really quite like that. They're the sort of company that don't say things like, oh, we tried that and it didn't work. They are like open to everything new and open to new technology. And that's kind of why I've ended up staying there. I've been there 5 years now. And then, you know, with Netflix buying them, that was really amazing. So we've inherited a lot of Netflix tech and structure. So, yeah, it's pretty good, actually. Enjoy it. And we're such a global company now. They've invested heavily into Korea, and some of those artists there, many of the artists there are just amazing. And yeah, we're sort of dotted all the way around the world. So yeah, pretty interesting. But
I've been really keen to talk to you about Andor because I adore it, and it was a great show at many, many levels.
What a gift.
Yeah, absolutely. But look, let me ask you a couple of questions right out of the gate, which is, I mean, the whole Star Wars / Mandalorian world pioneered LED volumes and stuff and did such a superb job in doing it. And it didn't feel like you went in that way at all with this. That hospital sequence, the attack in the hospital sequence, which I thought was great. But it's a sort of thing that, you know, you want to have stuff outside the windows and stuff. And so that would have thought that would have been an LED volume. But, of course, it wasn't. You were – well, tell me, what did you have to work with in terms of that set?
That set was pretty much just one floor, which we redressed, or the set team redressed to be all the different floors, because we visit three different floors in 19 in total. But yeah, as you astutely noticed, I looked at that when they sent it to me, and it's pretty much one floor and then blue above and blue below. And thought to myself, how the hell are we going to do that? Because it's reflections left, right and centre. And you know, Moen made the decision early on to only have a few pieces of glass that could be put in and out so that they would refract against the right corners. But the majority of time there's nothing there because it would have just reflected the lights on the set and the blue screen on the ground. So
there's a great shot where you're sort of looking through the wheel, or past some guys down to the explosion that's happening below. And I was just thinking, like, that's a lot of stuff to kind of coordinate. There's a lot of windows, a lot of glass, and you've got explosions and rattle and stuff. So in that shot, you would just had the foreground, presumably, with no glass. Otherwise, you'd have reflected the set.
No glass. There were reference plates of what – actually, there was one piece of glass to get the guards who were looking through down to the elevator. So we got that piece of their reflection, which was super useful because that tied it in together. And I got some good reflections and contact shadows on their feet. But everything else outside of that was all generated. The people inside the elevator were an element that we postage stamped smaller into our 3D elevator.
Sort of, but everything else in that field, it's like a sprite kind of thing, like as a 2D.
Yeah. Put them as a card, if you like, inside the elevator, and then worked on the reflections from that. Then all the people who were walking on the multiple floors, they were actually sprites, and that worked really well. We didn't go down the 3D route for building any people. And, you know, and again, I don't want to sound like too much of a suck-up, but Moen really planned it really well. Excellent job to work with.
So to get all those reflections, because the thing, and I was discussing with another supervisor recently, the problem with the reflections is you've been obviously don't want them, you can take them out. But when you're putting it back in, you need the opposite side of somebody. So I have their back, you need to see their face. So just putting a copy of the foreground in the reflection doesn't work because I need to see the other side of them effectively.
Yeah.
But you didn't have to do any digital doubles to sort of create reflections?
We didn't do digital doubles, but we did have witness camera footage that guessed the angle of reflection. So, for example, when our lead walks, the blonde woman who walks down the corridor, we set up a witness camera on the opposite side to catch her reflection. And it, amazingly, it did work. You know, there was a little bit of noodling. We had to recreate part of her legs. But, you know, just having her face from the correct side was an absolute gift.
Yeah, because, I mean, the thing that you want is, I mean, people aren't looking at the reflections, but if the reflections aren't there, you're kind of like, it's odd, right? So it sort of needs to be matching, but not necessarily, you know, unless it's a plot point, you're really not like looking at those reflections. And then presumably you had to do like a lot of environment work in that, as in the other areas, right? Because you're building out the rest of the hospital. And did you do exteriors, like establishing shots on the hospital?
Yeah, there's one where you can see a person approaching. It was shot in London at the Barbican, I think, where there's a sort of moment where the camera travels behind her and then we reveal the full hospital. And that was a DMP. And yeah, we kind of, you know, nothing is ever just a DMP, is it? It's always like 2.5D with projection. But I would say I had my team with a combination of 3D building and 2D reprojection within Nuke. That's how we did it in an expedient amount of time, because, you know, going back to your original point, when I looked at that footage and I thought, oh my God, there's one floor and we need to reflect 19 up. And it's also a U shape. So it was reflecting in on itself. But yeah, I really just tasked the team and said, listen, I'm not sitting there waiting for all those refraction passes to come in. We have to find a way of doing this, because I just previously done a show called Slumberland for Netflix, which had a glass city in it. And that nearly drove me mad, because, anytime you're working with glass, and I know visual effects have moved on and we've got games engines and, you know, you can do things really fast, but still.
Game engines aren't your sort of leaping off point for multi-layered refractions and deflections and reflections. So it's like,
15 hours later, you've got A-frame and then no way of actually completing. It looked great on that test frame, but I said to the team, like, no, we've got to find an efficient way of doing this, because it's a streaming show. And we were working on 8 episodes pretty much all at the same time, because, interestingly, episode number 1 delivered last. And so that was quite a stress right at the end. You get everything going. There were some reshoots, I think, for that one.
One of the other things I thought was fascinating is the stuff you had to do with the wheat field. For two reasons, right? Firstly, like, who the heck like has enough pre-production planning that it can plant a wheat field? I mean, that was just
Disney.
I mean, how brilliant was that? But the second thing is, I know you like doing practical stuff, and there's a lot of laser/gunfire at that location and explosions and stuff. And as I understand it, you couldn't light a match in that when it was actually a year later.
Yeah, exactly. So it was all digital. They did do squibs of Earth exploding, which was absolutely useful, because it gave us a guide to where they wanted things to be and what the physics of the day would be. But
if you'd done practical explosions, you could have had a massive fire of sort of near, biblical proportions. Yeah,
exactly. And I'll never look at a cornfield the same way. But it was beautiful, and that starting point was amazing, because it gave us all the foregrounds, which, as you know, is the trickiest part, and then extending off into the distance. But that was also, you know, that took a lot of artistic judgment, and I'm surrounded by people now who keep telling me that visual effects is all going to be replaced by AI shortly. It's not, not for a little while, because you always need that artistic eye. Like one thing that Moen and I really sort of like had a meeting of minds on is, having been in North America, when you see farming on a industrial level, you can see right off to the horizon. And I've shot films in Morocco, and you watch the clouds moving over the surfaces and those subtle movements. That's what we did in those shots, and it's so subtle, Mike, like, you know, I defy anyone else to see it, but that's the thing that really grounds it into I believe that. And so I'm a big fan of those smaller things that, you know, VFX soups look out for. Not everyone else does.
There are shots in there that are like, I presume either drone shots or like aerials. And similarly, when you did, which we'll get to in a second, the jungle stuff, where really you have just a blank canvas. But it did strike me that one of the things that might have helped was to get really good blocking and framing, because you've got an actual ground plane, an actual scale. I'm guessing that you got a really good kind of sense of what the shot needed to be, or were you still trying to find those in post?
We did do a fair amount of finding them in post. So, there's a moment where, and it's a really amazing moment at the end of the episode, where you see Cassian leaving the fields, the Mino Rao fields. You know, having left his best friend behind, and that is the moment where you go, oh, they built a whole field, but wow, it's now this size, and we had to extend that. And so I did have some fun blocking that out, and, you know, sort of working on the balance of the image. So there was a bit of backwards and forwards on that one. So we did do, hats off to the layout team. You know, I do enjoy that part of it. It's called layout in our visual effects world, but, you know, it's really sort of DOP training. We're setting up cameras and making it all good.
So even if we weren't friends, I have to say the thing that I love about your stuff is that you like physics, because I'm like notorious for getting upset when physics is wrong in films and just saying, but people intuitively understand gravity. And I have to say, like, the silo stuff and the stuff that you were doing in that just felt right. So thank you for that.
I know, I drive everyone crazy because I go, but it wouldn't have done that. And then, you know, directors may say to me, it doesn't matter, Sue, it's magic, or, you know, it's just roll with it. And I always try and find an angle back to that, because, you know, it's the uncanny valley of it. You know when it's right.
And you just sense that it's wrong, You especially sense scale, I think.
Yes, yeah, scale is really important. And, you're making me laugh at myself now, because whenever I look at any models or any simulations, I always go, put a 6-foot man in there and a meter cube. And, you know, and I want to see the balls and charts and, you know, and everything we do. And, you know, my teams at the beginning, when they start working, they're like, oh, so demanding. But, you know, you don't want to buy something if it's not the right scale, or if it isn't going to look right. So you've got to just ground it. I think that's the sort of artistic eye that you have to make things work.
Yeah, I think it's like, I mean, there are some things you can get away with. I mean, obviously, if things are flipping in space, you have no point of reference, and it's spaceships. And, you know, if it's I know you did some creature work in this, and again, you know, creatures. But when it comes to what you were doing on those cornfields, like, we have such an intuitive sense of that. It's not our planet, but we just assume it has Earth planet gravity type stuff. And we just know that in our DNA. And so we judge, you know, I mean, you know this better than anyone, but, like, we're not judging stereoscopically when it's in the distance, because, you know, the bifocal sort of the two-eye effect of determining scale isn't what it is. It's gravity. It's the way that things move. It's and that's the thing that sells the shot. And I just don't think it works when you fake it. I mean, your stuff worked so nicely in this, though.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. It's, I think, you know, the effects team that we were working with have huge experience in doing this kind of destruction, you know. I think there is a sort of thought in the industry that you used to go to Scanline for water, and then
well, that
since
was Independence what they
Day,
knew, yeah. That was the yeah, point it's there now where a lot it was the go-to.
Yeah. You mentioned the creature. Like, we had one creature, and I just loved it. I was like, please, mum, give me a creature, because he was going to be in, then he was going to be out. And the preface on that was like, this is a one-shot wonder. So, you know, they kind of gave it to us and said, block it out and we'll see if the showrunner likes it, Tony Gilroy. And I tasked one of our animators, a guy called Wolfie, and I was like, listen, I'm not going to buy this from you. Like, we're not spending weeks designing it. I'm not going to get into like muscle effects. Like, don't go down this technical rabbit hole. I want you to give me a quadruped, make it look like a prehistoric boar.
and it is attacking at night, right? So it's not like...
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, come on, don't overthink this, like, team. I want to get a creature in this. And like 10 days later, they turn up with this turntable of, you know, this kind of could be a rhino, could be, you know, prehistoric boar. It has a kind of elephant type surface on it, and it's at night in the rain. And I was like, right, we're doing it. Come on. And yeah, loving Moen kind of went, yeah, I like it. And it's in for a beat, but we're proud of it.
That's really interesting. If we just talk about this from a model point of view for a second and technically. So yeah, some of the things like a TIE fighter, you were getting, I think, shared assets from ILM, yeah, and we know that, and it's like a well-worn. And then this is the exact opposite, right? This is like, we may never see it again. And you have a lot of freedom, but then you don't have the budget that you do to put into an asset that's going to be used in multiple episodes.
Yeah. So, Scanline actually have quite a lot of creature work. And I had done, we had just done another couple of shows where we had quadruped characters. So I think the interesting thing with this is I kind of had a lot of freedom to do what we could do in a short amount of time. It wasn't like someone had really spent a long time saying, it has to be eight-legged with tentacles. It was like, what can you do in this amount of time? So I was like, I got a quadruped rig. and then, we sort of turn his head and open his mouth. I'd just done Meg 2 with a dinosaur in the opening titles. So I sort of lent into that, this kind of reptilian mouth that kind of shakes. And so, if you like, it's stuff that I'd done before with experience that we were able to sort of do in
well, I don't know if you'd so much done it before as you knew what worked visually, right? Because it's an original creature. So
Oh, exactly. Yeah. But you kind of lean into things that you go, I guess I just knew that they weren't going to overthink this one. So I actually, a bit naughty, but I kind of held it back until I had a lighting pass. And then showed them. Whereas, more traditionally, on the vendor side, you would go, here's the model, here's the turntable. But I asked the team to kind of push that, just knowing that it would either be a yes or a no. So we got in.
So you were talking before about how well Scanline pioneered work in fluid sims. And this film, when you're doing a lot of sims work, I presume, at least I've heard on the grapevine, that you're using a lot of Houdini and stuff. Is that, what's the sort of pipe at your end?
Yeah, it's so we still have a little bit of the oh my gosh, what is it? I've forgotten the name of it. That's terrible. The proprietary software that we use for water. But the truth is that we need to be scaling in all parts of our business at the same time. And the original software for making the water was so proprietary that I think it was, I'm kind of trying to be politically diplomatic. It's hard to scale up on a sort of global level when you are working with multiple teams. And the truth is that Houdini actually, is such a malleable tool that we took what we understood from the physics of the practical of the proprietary software and applied that. So the same artists that we're using our proprietary software, are now using the Houdini. There's a sort of back end and a front end that's been written around it. But I think it comes down to skill sets of the artists. I've got artists who really just love visual effects, and they get it that it's not about what the buttons that you press. It's like, how does it look? And, there's some absolute gems at Scanline, and there always will be, because they attract that kind of work and they attract those kind of teams.
Yeah, absolutely. And tell me, how distributed is Scanline now? Like, I know that obviously you mentioned the Netflix thing, but how many teams?
So we got Vancouver, Montreal, and we worked with the Montreal team on Andor and the European team. So it was London and Germany, Montreal. Now, we didn't actually use the Korean team on Andor, but yeah, there's a big Korean team, and there's an Indian team as well now.
Excellent. And on this show...
And a US LA team as well, of course, with the eyeline side of things.
And on this show, I think you did what about on Andor? You did about 550 or something like that in terms of shot count?
I thought it was about 800, but...
Oh, really? Okay.
I'll find out more from Zarina in the end.
And that the majority actually was in the environment of the wheat fields with the sort of...
Yeah, although one thing that I haven't talked about much with on interviews is the Mothmar estate stuff. I don't know whether you've noticed that in the showreel. It's the wedding moment, and that was all shot outside on a green screen. And we put all of those Dolomite Mountains into the background. And there's one shot in there, Mike, that is about 30 seconds long. It was the time of the wunna. You know what? Everyone loves a wunna. That whole episode is wunnas the whole way through. And I ate my hat on that so many times because the roto work on that was so tough. But it was the only way to do it. There were sections of green screen everywhere, but we soon shot off it. And we had to recreate that whole environment. And that was pretty big. But yeah, the wunnas kill me.
Yeah, I mean, they are difficult. But there was a... If I remember, there was like a kind of a dance thing in that sequence, yeah. Right? Like was there a sort of disco droid disco or something?
Bot. Yeah, the disco bot came in. That was brilliant. I had some fun on that one. They built a practical disco bot because, you know, we all love a practical disco bot. But, of course, it couldn't fly through the air.
So was that on wires or?
No, we just made a digital version of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in scanning that, did you do LiDAR scanning or like how did you reconstruct and do stuff with that?
I think it might even been a prop scan and then a lot of photogrammetry. I think Clear Angle did the work on that. They're an excellent company that do really high quality work. And then we built that and obviously we had HDRs for the reflections and the environments. And then
because there was small glass, right?
Yeah. And it was the fun bit about that was that they had a disco track that we had to time the lights to. And so, yeah, you know me, I like a shortcut. We did all of the timings in Nuke. So I had it, you know, full on with the lights on and little ramps going up and down. And then in Nuke, we kind of timed it. So I just remember in Daily sitting there going, no, you're off the beat. No, up and down, up and down. But yeah, bit of fun.
That makes it particularly hard if anyone does a re-edit or just, you know, wants to extend anything because there's like a cascading effect through the edit, right?
Yeah. We did wait until we had a locked shot for that because that could have been painful. But that's why I did it in Nuke as well. I was thinking I can't go for like re-renders, you know, so if there were changes, and to be honest, it went pretty smoothly, we could have, it didn't mean re-rendering all the passes all over again because, as you know, I hate that.
So as you're talking about this and people are listening, like, tell me, what's your sort of like daily, I mean, it sounds like you're actually doing stuff yourself in Nuke, or are you just sitting there in dailies a lot and talking with the artists? So like, walk me through.
I wish I could do stuff in Nuke. Yeah, no, I'm terrible. I would take the mouse off someone and start doing it myself, but my team tell me to back off. Now I am pointing and answering the phone, but I still love it. And I think the one thing that I do like about being a VFX supervisor is that you do a little bit of everything. And as you know, Mike, I've been doing this for a while. I started off in animation. I moved to 3D lighting. Then I got into comp because I was like, oh, I've got to finish this as well. I can't hand this off to anyone else. I think I even used to do my own roto. So I've done bits of everything. So I think when people go, oh, you can't do that, I always go, oh, I think you can. Give it to me and I'll have a go.
So I said I wanted to get back to the vines and the temples and stuff. We discussed the creature work there, but maybe you could walk through, maybe that's the right, I hope it's the right environment to discuss, but like just in terms of digital matte paintings and stuff, like what is that process for you and the team? You're obviously getting concept art from the production as a sort of starting point.
Yeah, and obviously the concept artwork is just phenomenal for, you know, this kind of level and the teams that they employ. We were given really great reference. And, of course, you know, all you have to do is look at previous Star Wars moments and Andor 2 precedes Rogue One. So, you know, I did a lot of referencing Rogue One and the other episodes. Yes, so approaching the temples and the flying in towards the temples, that was, we chose to do 3D assets. So we built like three temples and had variations on each side of the temple. So I build three assets and then, you know, when we needed to see different temples in the distance, I just rotate them. so that we didn't get, you know, super heavy with models. Planned it in layout, worked on the camera moves. Those shots actually did have digital people in them, sort of bringing in the air traffic control, if you like. As you mentioned, the U-wings, the X-wings, the Y-wings, they were all shared from ILM. The designs of the shots, you know, we had some fun with the cameras in and out, matching the plates.
The digital matte paintings, the DMPs, are you doing you must have sort of some 3D that obviously is feeding some of that. You're going to end up with stuff you're projecting, but have you got sort of digital paint over on stuff before you're projecting it, or are you relying on?
Yeah, so that was the plan for those, is that we would sort of build them well, texture them to a certain level, and then put them into shots and reproject from there, which did work pretty well. As you would have noticed, lots of the shots are in quite moody environments. We've got one that I think, you know, is rain and then lightning. So there was not too much of a need to get up too close. And, you know, for the daylight shots where you do see the temples in the background, there was a very large set that was built out at Longcross. So lots of the stuff directly behind.
Are you getting that stuff clean, or are you adding in rain and smoke and stuff to make it?
Adding in rain and smoke.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's really hard to film rain without it bucketing down to actually even read on camera, let alone anything else.
Yeah, that was all digital passes. We did, I think that the nice thing about it, and the thing that we all do in visual effects, is, you know, that the final icing on the cake is sort of the foliage and doing digital scatter and the vines. So, that did take some time, and there was a lot of trial and error with that, sort of growing the vines over the surfaces of the temples did take a lot of time. I'm laughing at the memories.
So when you say that that's the last stage, do you mean in terms of selling the locality, or you mean like because they're moving they give sort of subtle
just the final scale of it, I think. Right. We never saw moving vines, but I did build them in 3D. I love scale. You have to make sure that the leaves are the correct scale, you know, even at the incredible distance that we're at. But again, that's the thing that blows it and gives it away. So, yeah, I did a lot of digital scatter. And then once that was done to a certain level, let's say 90%, then I put that into the shot, and then we did DMP on top of that to sort of do the final stuff, because again, you know, that's where madness lies if you're going to start art directing single vines and all that kind of stuff. So we did a lot of paint overs on sort of 90%
right
perfect 3D vines,
because not at that location, but there were other locations where you were using green screen, like Cassian's walking across a bunch of a hangar of stuff, and you're still getting some green screen. But then on set, you said you came in for the end of shooting on set, like, what's there to show the actors what's going on those environments? Because you're doing a lot of set extension, a lot of world building. Is there much, concept art? Is there anything else that's happening on set to help inform the actors as to what's going to be around them?
The sets were pretty big for those hangar shots. They built, a hangar, one-to-one size, but... Yeah, you're right. I mean, what we see and what ends up in the final product, you know, in one of those shots where, you know, Cassian's walking towards us and it's a real kind of like slow motion moment, you know, back in the background, there's catering, you know, there's the makeup tent, there's all that kind of stuff, which we sort of meticulously remove. And I know what it's like, you know, shooting, you can't always get a perfect plate, but I do think there was a lot of planning. TJ and Moen planned a lot of those shots really well. So I didn't have to, it's my favourite thing. Just as long as I get a screen behind someone's head, don't make me roto hair, that's the best way to work. And then, you know, there's other stuff that's easier to roto, but there's some stuff that's still as hard as it ever was back in, you know, the days of, matte painting and digital separation or element separation.
Well, what you are getting at those locations, as you would have got at the wheat field, is you're getting terrific light, because even if you've got a green screen behind someone for hair, I just think the light falling from no matter how big it is, put a super sun in there and stick it on a giant arm, it's still never going to look right when it's compared to actual sunlight.
Working with a DOP that really understands that is huge, because there was a period in time where people would go, oh, you know, you can do it all digitally. I'll just put a 20K behind you and it'll look great. And you know, I think that's where the visual effects suffered, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, that, you know, there's nothing better than getting an actual sun in a shot, you know, and we can pull keys from green screens that are shot by the sun. It doesn't have to be in a controlled environment. Yeah. I would always advocate for shooting outdoors on a screen where possible, because you get, you know, natural wind, natural fall off, natural undulation in the light, and all those things we mimic.
Having said that, I think one of the things that AI is holding promise out for is deriving virtual surface normals to allow for relighting. Like maybe not for a full sunlight shot like we're just discussing, but like you've got somebody in a cockpit and you can relight them. And I mean, I know Scanline / Paul De Bevic and all the other guys have been doing really interesting work with relighting for years, but we're now seeing those synthetic AI simulations of relighting allowing for a lot more realism to help sit something in.
Well, when this next project finishes, I'm going to sit in this very cramped loft and really get into Runway, and I'm probably not supposed to say the names of them, anyway, get into whatever AI tools are available to me and really enjoy myself, because I love a good concept. And now, you know, I used to make mood boards, or still make mood boards, you know, designs, draw stuff myself, and, you know, get shutterstock footage at other films. And now I think using those tools with the correct prompts will get us there so much faster. So I think for a VFX soup and, you know, art direction in general, those tools are just amazing, aren't they?
Yeah, though that was actually referring not so much to using them for conceptualizing a shot, though that is obviously super interesting. No, I just sort of meant like actually being able to take a shot like you right now or me, and then have it work out what the surface normals are probabilistically likely to be, hence allowing us to sort of relight a shot. And I think that holds out, because I mean, I think getting the lighting to sell a shot is like we were talking about with gravity before. Like, it's just so hard to pick it when you're looking at it, but if it's the lighting is just not kind of matching, you just intuitively feel like it's wrong.
Yeah, I haven't had any experience of relighting in that way, but
I got into a lot of trouble recently on a podcast because we were criticizing a shot that we thought the lighting was wrong, and they did it 100% in camera, but it was fireworks and lights at a stadium, and we were like, no, that's so fake, it's such a bad comp. And of course they were like, no, it's 100% in camera. So it is hard to judge, I know, but you know,
yeah, it is so tricky. But yeah, that's the stuff, really. I think it, you know, technology is moving around us and we're enjoying it and trying to keep up with it. But, you know, the age old thing is still the same. Does it look right? And I think the hardest thing as a VFX soup is when it doesn't look right, how to fix it.
Oh yeah. The ability to articulate what is wrong in a shot where everybody is saying, doesn't feel quite right, and they want it to look more authentic, and it's like, okay, I can't use the authentic button, I need that translated into something that we can actually address is I think the skill that you have, and that is invaluable.
No, that does make me laugh. I remember a boss who shall remain nameless said, you won't be able to say this, but you know, said, oh, why does it look like shit, fix it, Sue, and walked out the room. And I just thought, I wish I could say that to my team. But I have to sit there and go, oh, hang on, let's take the layers off. What's wrong? But yeah, you know, is that the fun of it? That's what keeps me up at night, trying to fix those things. But I
think the other thing that you're facing, and certainly this show is an example of it, is that you have an incredibly informed audience. So the audience, you know, let's face it, on an earlier Star Wars project, and I was one of them, would just sit there in awe. And looking at the shots now, I'm like, hang on a second, that like level doesn't look very good. And my kids now are like picking shots, and I'm like, actually, I thought that was really good.
Oh yeah.
So you've got a very informed fan base for a, and I don't mean like fanboys. I mean like just the audience is just so visually literate with these images exactly. that you're producing. Yeah. You just have to get that realism at a level that is intuitive. Yeah.
I think one of the things that was kind of cool on this show was Tony Gilroy wanted to really keep us grounded in, you know, the grittiness of Rogue One and the early Star Wars stuff. So anytime it went too kind of magical, we were just knocked right back into the grittiness of it. You know, in so much as, you know, sometimes I'd look at the footage and think, oh, you know, we could add something extra in the background here. And, you know, Mo would go, no, that's not right for this moment. You know, we're trying to keep it all as if they really are on Mina Rao and they are a farming community. Like, don't build a spaceship in the background. Like, you know, it's the odd moment when something goes past and that's when they're all looking at it. So, yeah, I think I think it might have been easier on Andor because of that reason, because we weren't pushed into doing that many sort of crazy battles. And there were some sort of kept in the roots of it.
I mean, I'm not alone in thinking that Andor has been one of the most successful projects visually for the Star Wars universe because of that kind of fine balance between realism, grittiness, and just damn good kind of story really propelled it. So I'm so glad we got a chance to talk to you about it. Thank you so much. And congratulations. It's great work.
Oh, thank you. I'll pass that on to the team because, we all sit there, don't we? Especially, you know, we were all working from home on this project. And, you know, I was talking to the German teams. When I was in Vancouver, I was talking to the German team. So I was getting up at like 6 a.m. and that was their 3 in the afternoon. And then I'd stay on for the Montreal team. And then, you know, I'd be like, then I moved to the UK and it all like went around the other way and I'd be like 8 o'clock in the evening and they're, you know, the Montreal team are taking their lunch and I'm like, oh, I just want to go to bed. I'm knackered. But it all pays off in the end, Mike. Let's hope so.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for doing this on my evening, your morning.
I know.
On the other side of the planet. You.
Friday evening. Gosh, have a pint now.
No, it's Saturday night here.
Oh, is it? I've got the days wrong for you.
No, no problem. I'm about to go to dinner. Yeah, I'm in the future.
Well, it's always lovely talking to you, Mike. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks so much.
Well, thanks for taking time to chat with us, Sue. It was really interesting to hear your insights regarding the project, as well as your focus on the importance and need for an artist's eye, even as AI tools begin to reshape workflows. It's something you've brought up in other conversations here at Effects Guide as well, and it's always great to hear from you. Well, that's it for this episode. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening to this FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.